Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Everybody, Andy Richter here with another episode of The Three Questions, and I've got David Duchovny on today, the multi-talented. It's embarrassing how many things you do.
It's embarrassing to me.
Is it? Yeah. I mean, because you do music, you do poetry, you write novels, and then you act in things too, which is like, once you do acting, why do you do all that work? You found a cush gig, you know?
Well, that's absolutely right. You know, acting is, it's nice to have your words written for you, but as you know, there are long days on set that you start to feel like existential dread of, you know, what the hell am I doing?
Yeah.
You know, waiting around trying to get these few lines right all day. So there's something about writing novels or making music that's a little, I have a little more agency, I guess.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask, if it's a control thing, because.
Well, people, you know, control is like a negative word to people.
But it's, I mean, not to me. I mean, you know, agency, it's just, it's a semantic game then, because it is control. Like that's, I mean, we all want to, I don't know. We're all like scared animals, you know, in this big crazy world, and we want to be able to feel like we got some handle on it. So, yeah, I mean, I understand. And especially on movies, on TV shows, you know, they are inherently necessarily collaborative, but that can also leave you feeling like, you know, a ship's crew member on the deck heading to a horizon and you don't know what the fuck's going on. You know,
well, you're lucky if you're on the deck.
Yeah.
I think, you know, when you think about it, your performance, well, you have the lines written mostly, and, you know, somebody's going to light you, somebody's going to shoot you, somebody's going to cut you. So there's all these factors that go into your quote unquote performance as an actor that are really not in your control at all.
So. And it's also, I'm always amazed too at like how really, you know, like your job is just to kind of find this quiet place where you can focus on saying the shit right, you know, and you're doing it sort of in the middle of a traffic jam
of a construction zone.
Yeah. Now you grew up in New York City.
Yeah.
And I want to get back to that too, because this does prompt a question that I was curious about. You went to school for English literature. You were in pursuit of a PhD, was it? English literature?
Yeah.
How does acting happen along that way? I mean, is it something that you were really wanted to do, or was it just
I had never thought it was a good gig. Yeah, I had never thought about it really. I had I'd never grown up knowing an actor. I mean, the closest I ever came to an actor was I knew some guy whose dad was on the Breckstone commercials. That was about it. I don't know if you remember those.
It's an Eastern thing, but I mean, from living in New York, I know Breckstone, but we didn't have them when I was a kid. So.
Yeah. So that was it. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, if I was watching Gilligan's Island, which was a show I'd watch as a kid, I, I didn't even relate to those people as actors. I just related to them as Gilligan and whatever.
Ginger and Marianne.
I didn't think, oh, what does Gilligan wear when he's not being Gilligan? Does he take that hat off? Does he eat food? I don't know. So I had no thoughts about that, but I wanted to be a writer, and I thought if I was a professor, if I was teaching, then I would be able to have 3 or 4 months of the year off in which I would write. And it seemed like that was that looked like the structure of my life in a way.
Yeah.
And isn't
your mom a teacher?
My mom was a teacher for many, many years. Yeah.
In
New York City. Yeah. And my sister is a teacher in Brooklyn right now. So, as a writer, I just began to feel very kind of isolated and lonely. Kind of the things that I like about it now.
Yeah, yeah.
when I was 21, I hated about it.
Yeah.
So I thought, how can I write and not be so alone? And then I thought, well, plays. I'll write plays, and then, you know, the actors will have to come and do, you know, and then we'll direct and we'll do it that way.
Come and entertain me and keep me company. Keep me from being so sad.
Say my words.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, if I'm gonna write plays, I should probably know something about acting. So I was at Yale at the time, and they have so many productions going on at all times, big and little. But they basically looking for bodies. You know, they don't have enough in the acting school there to cast everything they're doing. So I started hanging out over at the drama school and actually taking like playwriting courses and met the actors, and they said, hey, you know, we need a body here, we need a body there. And I just started to act that way. And, you know, here I am.
So you sat in on the acting classes?
I didn't sit on an acting classes. I sat in on playwriting classes. I don't think it's very weird, because if you were like, my program was, English literature. I was getting a PhD in that.
Yeah.
If you said, hey, I like books too, you couldn't just come in and sit in our class. But somehow they let me. That was just waltz in, and I'd sit there, and God, you know, they kind of had an open door policy, which was cool for me. But no, not with the acting. I didn't study any acting there.
Yeah. So did you have a technique, or did you just wing it? Fake it.
Well, at first I winged it and faked it, which is what I eventually get back to. You know, after all the technique, then you get back to winging.
Absolutely.
So, at first, but then you know, when I started to take it seriously or started to actually want to work, I got into some classes in New York. So I was actually commuting between New Haven and New York. I had like this double life where I was a PhD candidate and a TA, a teaching assistant. And then I'd ride my bike to the New Haven train station, get it on the train, take it to my bike to class. And then, and we were learning Strasbourg technique. And then I took a different class, which was Meisner technique. So I've kind of worked around in both the major, you know, acting techniques of this country's of the 20th century anyway. You know, for me, it's like, you know, it's whatever works on the day. You know, we're fluid beings, right? So you show up on set and you were caught in traffic and you're in a shit mood. Well, now you've got to figure this out. So you can either use that, what's happening today, or if that's not working, you got to search back and use your technique and try to make it happen. And then worst comes to worst, you just fucking fake it. Like,
Yeah, because that's, I always, when I don't know what to, you know, the most I can ever get about sort of acting technique that I understand. By the way, sorry about the dog.
Never apologize about a dog.
Okay,
that's my credo.
She gets worked up because people walk in front of the house. She's got to go to the backyard and bark.
It's a house.
Yeah, yeah. My whole career has been, oh shit, they're going to give me this opportunity. It would be rude of me to act as if I don't know what I'm doing, because everybody else here is treating me as if I know what I'm doing. So just to be polite, I'm going to say, you're right, I do know what I'm doing. And then I'm just going to fucking hope that somebody likes, you know, when a director says, okay, we got it. And then they frequently will say, unless it's really something that I enjoy, they'll say, do you want to do anything? And usually it's no, it's you. I want to go home. That's what I want to do. So
but it's funny that you describe it that way, because I would describe like the technique of your technique and Conan and the show as, let me try to get this right off what you were just saying, as acting like you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
That was like the fundamental humor of the show was, we are so bad at this. We don't know what we're doing. No, that was
we what were supposed to be suave. That's what we were going for.
But you know what I mean? That's funny that you put your you know, because clearly you were preparing. Clearly you didn't know what you're doing. But the style, which I always loved and which was funny, was, I just got here. What am I supposed to do?
Yeah, well, my philosophy with that show, and it built over time. I mean, first of all, I've done a lot of press lately about what that all means. So I've been talking about it lately, which I don't, you know, how often do you really, how far would you have to live up to your own ass to think, what have I meant to the comedy community, unless somebody asks me? So I have been thinking about it lately, and I didn't, you know, when I first got the job, we just were doing it because it was a comedy job. It was this kind of show, and we got to fill up this amount of time. And I haven't done it before, but we'll figure something out. But to me, what that show ended up being was, is it had to be about, every single one was kind of like a documentary about these two guys that did this for an hour a day. Right. And the key to it, to me, was always, people have to experience this hour in the same way that we're experiencing this hour.
Yeah.
So it was always important to me to be myself and to react to things in as much of an honest way as I could. I mean, right. It is show business, and I do, you know, like I say, it's a version of me, but when it's like me when company's over, like me on my best behavior or most, you know, because I mean, if it was just me, there would have been plenty of interviews where I didn't say a fucking thing and, you know, did a crossword on my phone or something.
Well, I'll just say, you know, and I know that's not what, you know, we're supposed to be talking about here, and that's fine, because I'd rather talk about you than me. But I read an article. This is why I sought out your podcast, as a matter of fact. I don't listen to a lot of podcasts. So I read this article. I think it must have been in the Times, in the New York Times. And I thought you were really sincere and thoughtful. And I liked what you were saying. Then I read that you had a podcast, and I thought, I'd like to do that podcast. And
oh, great.
Not putting so pressure on you to be sincere and thoughtful. but why I was predisposed to wanting to do it as well was because I had always enjoyed your persona, not only as a viewer, but also as a participant in the Conan show. And you always had a real, there was always a real generosity to what you were doing, and a kind-heartedness that wasn't like, it wasn't faked at all.
Oh, thank you.
If it was faked at all, it was faked well, you know. And I thought your timing was always great, and you always just made me laugh so much. So I was like, and then I read, this is what this guy's really been thinking about. I said, that's interesting. Like he's,
oh, thanks.
He's kind of a little, he's a little tortured there. That's cool.
Well, I mean, you know, it was a weird job. It was a job to which I was very suited in many ways. And I kind of described that in the article, and that like, I kind of from an early age was in charge of morale and was kind of there to react to whatever happened. So I kind of was bred to do this kind of job. It does get to be, you know, you get tired of being, I say a lot, and I've said this numerous times to showbiz wives, I understand. Like, I understand what it is to be a showbiz wife, because I was kind of his TV wife. So I understand, like, this is great. This is wonderful. We have a great job. But sometimes I get annoyed that people don't pay attention to me or, you know, or kind of look at me as an accessory to somebody else.
Well, here's it's very interesting for me to hear you say that, because there were moments when I'd be on the show, and this is a while ago, I can't remember the last time I did it. And it's okay that you guys didn't invite me back for the big goodbye run.
Even though I had nothing to do with that.
Even though we had some classic bits.
Someday I'll tell you about all the people that were truly hurt. If you were truly hurt,
because
there were some people. Yeah, there's some stories about who got emails from whom.
There were times when I felt my attention wandering to you more than I felt was okay. and I felt like, I feel like there's a little, I can't increase this tension here. I've got to take my eyes off Andy right now.
Yeah.
And get back over here.
It was, I mean, and there's not like a lot of tension between me and Conan.
Oh, no.
You know, I mean, honestly, and as time has gone on, the pressure has gotten less and less because we've understood like we do a volume business. Everyone doesn't matter that much unto itself, except for if everybody had fun. And that was kind of, we got to that. It took a long time to get to that. But I would make me nervous too. The one that would make me the most nervous was Jane Lynch, whom I've known since about 1988. And we actually were in we did a show called The Real Life Brady Bunch, and she and I were Carol and Mike. Right. And she used to do this thing on the show. I mean, she still kind of did it even towards the end, where she'd be on the show and Conan would ask her a question and she'd turn to me and answer it. And I always was sitting there feeling like, look at him. Look at him. Yeah. He's the one you should be looking at.
I used to like to think about bits to do when I would do Conan, and one of the bits I did on Conan had really terrible repercussions for me in my life.
The Vancouver thing.
Yeah.
Well, now it was so silly though, because they were very soft. Vancouver, you came on the show when he was doing it. Was he doing a week of shows in Vancouver? Was that it?
No. I was just. There were rumors at the time that the show was moving from Vancouver to LA I just got married and I was one of those people, you know, pushing for that.
Cause I don't think I was on the show when this happened.
You weren't?
What year was this?
Probably 98, 99.
Oh, then I was there. I was there. Yeah. Yeah. I remember.
You're not getting
out
of it that way.
I mean, I remember. I mean, this whole last month has been weird to see hours of tape that I don't have any recollection of.
Yeah.
But I specifically remember you telling Vancouver jokes and there being a backlash. But I don't have a memory of it happening on air.
It was a really great gag because it was Conan is going to ask me, well, why do you want to move the show? And I would say, say something negative about Vancouver. And I said something about that it rained a lot. And then it was your guy's idea, which was great. And I loved it. Was like, you're going to cut to the audience and they're going to see a bear, a Mountie and a hockey player crying, like dabbing. Hey, you're laughing now.
Yeah.
I was like, great gag.
Yeah.
And then, but unfortunately, the next day it was reported in the Vancouver papers, almost as if I'd held a press conference and said, who can live in Vancouver? It rains too much. And I went on a PR defensive.
Wow.
For months and couldn't set it straight that I actually, here's the truth, that I loved Vancouver and actually like a lot of rain myself temporarily.
Yeah.
But there was no going back. There was no taking it back.
People are so touchy about that kind of stuff. I mean, and it's like, it's the softest.
It's the weather.
Most cliched thing that you can make fun of that town about, you know?
Well, I think what it was is that we were, you know, I think Vancouver felt protective of us. You know, I get it, you know, and I think they were hurt or in some collective way hurt that we were leaving and that it just came out this way. And I get it all, you know?
Yeah.
And I love them too, and I love that place too. So yeah. I understand, and it just kind of took this weird form.
Yeah.
But one time I remember, I wanted to come on, and I said to the producer, I can't remember who I was. I said, I want to bring a guitar and then just on with me. And I didn't play guitar at the time. I said, I want to bring a guitar. And then Conan would logically ask me about the guitar. And I would say, don't ask me about the guitar. I told you. And they didn't go for it. And I was always upset. I was like, I said, that's so fucking funny. Will you let me just do it?
Yeah.
Don't ask me about the guitar. I told you, we went over this.
I'll tell you why they said no, is because it's like a, and I'm not the big theater student, but it's, isn't there like the, is it Chekhov's gun that are like, if you bring out a gun, somebody's got to use it?
It's known as Duchovny's guitar now.
Somebody's got to play that fucking thing.
Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at Curology.com/SXM. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation, subscription required. Cancel anytime.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
Well, did you find yourself, when you started taking those acting classes, did you find yourself kind of energized by the challenge of the technique and it took over where writing had been your drive?
Less writing and more like sports, because I had been, well, obviously I've been like pretty intellectual. I've been doing well in school and I was moving on that way and those institutions of higher learning and stuff like that, but I hadn't really exercised my emotional being in the same way or my performance being since I played sports, you know, and that was, I loved the game. I loved the pressure of a game. So I related to it like that. It was like, oh, this is like having a ball in my hands again, you know?
Yeah.
And, I still think it's like that. You know, I get the nerves. I get, you know, I get excited to play. And aside from that, it was accessing emotions. That was never anything I was like, lauded for doing. Like nobody said, hey, David, you know, be more emotional. That's not, that wasn't what they were saying at Princeton and Yale, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So for me, it was really a place where I could mature and explore emotionally, which wasn't something necessarily part of my education before that.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my God, I can have all these emotions and be these ways and I don't have to go to jail.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not breaking anybody's heart. Nobody's killing themselves because I'm being such an asshole.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I enjoy that. I enjoy that exploration, you know? And then, of course, humor was something too. It was like, oh, I can make people laugh. I like doing that.
Yeah.
I like
doing that. And you don't, there isn't, you know, especially in English literature. And I mean, I don't know what Yale is like, but there's not a lot of concern about where the laughs are in those programs. You know what I mean? It's like,
I don't know. You know, it's like people do have certain misconceptions about that because I've just been talking about it with my daughter who's studying English right now too. And we were talking about how funny Kafka is. I know that's a really silly thing to say.
Yeah, yeah. Like,
if you don't approach it as this kind of hallowed piece of of literature, you know, enshrined on the Mount Everest of literature. It's fucking funny. And so is Beckett. And so is Joyce. There's a Shakespeare. I mean, and, if Shakespeare done well, you're laughing.
Yeah. The guy Pinter, like I find, Pinter, like all those long stretches of just
silence
and meaningless drivel is just hilarious. And you're right. You know, like waking up as a cockroach is pretty fucking funny. You know what I mean? Like, oh shit, I'm a cockroach now.
Right. Yeah. I have the same consciousness. Of,
person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I started in college and I took a lot of English classes and it didn't seem that fun. And when I remember, well, also too, when you're like a freshman and a sophomore in college and you think you're going to write something and it's going to be important and it's always so dreary, you know? And so, you know, it's like when I transferred to film school, it's a cliche that everybody's first film that's not just an exercise is about suicide. Like all these, it's just a film school cliche. Yes. If you go watch the first crop of everybody's doing a short film that they all are just, you know, that they all decided on, it's their thing. It's, you'll go through, if there's 10, there's six of them are about suicide, somebody killing themselves. I mean, that's the way it was. I don't know. Now it's probably about superheroes, you know, now, but yeah, it's, I never found, I tried to write one funny story and I felt it was like, well, this is really funny. Okay, let's move on to Jeremy's. You know, that was, it didn't really seem like there was anything sort of substantive to it, which, you know, I mean, I don't really care one way or the other. I mean, I do think comedy is the most perishable of entertainments.
Really?
Yeah, I do. I think that things that were funny 30 years ago.
Stylistically, sure.
Yeah. I mean, just basic funny. Things that were funny 30 years ago, just...
Well, certainly, yeah, last couple of years.
Yeah.
But
some stuff, you know, it doesn't age well.
I couldn't disagree more. I mean, I agree that yes, styles change and that and certain subject matters are going to become highlighted culturally and become either more or less funny over time. But I think that to make people laugh, you know, to make people laugh in the most fundamental way is not attached to the style of the day or the news of the day, really. It's more of a, you know, to me, it's just a big joke that we're here on this planet and we have to die, you know?
Yeah.
And we know it. So comedy to me is the highest, you know, I mean, obviously within drama, you know, I mean, my heart goes to the things that are mixed. But to me, like the most evolved response to many situations is to try to see what's funny in it, you know?
Yeah. And that, you know, like Vancouver. Try and find out what's funny about Vancouver, and then you find out quickly what's not funny.
Yes. I found out what's not, which is almost as valuable as finding out what is.
Yeah. Now you are, do you live in New York City still or?
No. My son graduated from high school last month.
Uh-huh.
And that's pretty much it for me.
Really?
Yeah.
And are you here in California or?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cause you're a New York City boy. You're a New York City baby. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you grow up you grew up downtown? Is that correct?
Yeah. I grew up on, well, Lower East Side, I guess you call it, but like 18th and 3rd and then 11th and 2nd.
Yeah.
Those are my cribs.
Yeah. And those are, you know, those are pretty normal neighborhoods in terms of like Manhattan, that being a mix of people living there, but also a lot of street action, you know?
My neighborhood when I was growing up was this odd mixture of Ukrainian and Puerto Rican.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, wonderful. You know, pierogies and cerveza, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That was a very Chicago thing too. There was a lot of neighborhoods that were overlapped Ukrainian. It was one called Ukrainian Village that was Ukrainian and but Mexican. But it was all overlapping and Polish overlapped with Mexican. When I was when I was in Chicago, you could run into people on Milwaukee Avenue that had lived in Chicago for 20 years and didn't speak a word of English because they didn't need to. They could just speak Polish, you know.
Right. So my neighborhood was, it was completely just, it was literally a melting pot, you know.
Yeah. I mean,
it was like the cliche of what America likes to think of itself as. You
know? What drew, I mean, are your folks from that neighborhood? What drew, no, what drew them to that neighborhood? Wow. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
My father was born in Brooklyn. So he worked in Manhattan and, you know, I guess they just decided to live there. I mean, my mother had never really wanted to stay in America, but she's 91. She's still trying to get out of here. But yeah. So my dad born in Brooklyn, mom born in Scotland, and they settled on Lower East Side.
They just picked it. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was a great place to grow up. I mean, there was a lot of freedom. You know, you weren't really aware of the horrible things that can happen. I mean, you know, there was the occasional, you know, horrible thing that could happen, but it wasn't in everybody's minds that a child could get snatched off the street and disappear forever.
Right. You know? Right.
So I had a lot of liberty and a lot of autonomy, and you know, the city is great for that because you don't need to be in a car. You know, you can just go wherever you need to go.
Yeah. Did you ever sort of exercise that freedom to the point of being dangerous?
Of me being dangerous or getting into a dangerous
situation? Getting into dangerous situations.
I'm sure that I did, you know, I'm sure that I didn't know it at the time, you know, I'm sure I pushed, you know, boundaries, but you know, I just had that kind of, when you're young, you just don't think, you know, you're just doing shit.
You know?
So, I mean, I never broke any, you know, big ticket laws, you know,
right.
Just little ones, you know, graffiti and shit like that. But
yeah. Because I have a 15-year-old and a 20-year-old, and people have often asked me, you know, people with younger kids, like, how do you give them freedom when they start going out by themselves? What do you do and all this stuff? And, you know, and I've always felt that any advice was tempered with the fact that, like, my kids just weren't built to be trouble seekers. You know, they both were kind of, like, my son is very kind of almost overly cautious in a way. Mm-hmm. And my daughter, as she's gotten older, has been that way too. So I always just wonder, like, you know, I think, like, you are who you are, and your parents can either give you freedom or they can give you strict boundaries depending on what they think you need. I mean, if they're doing it right. Some parents are just like, see ya. Have a good time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as a parent, you know, you realize early on, you know, that your kids may be a mixture of you and your spouse, but they are their own thing, you know? And, you know, like, that water is going to seek its own level in some way. And all you can do is just like yell warnings from the sideline. Watch out for that.
Yeah. Did you ever, when you were younger, like, did you ever covet a more sort of suburban lifestyle?
Never, because I just didn't know it. I mean, you mentioned the Brady Bunch. I did covet that. I was like, man, that's a nice house. That California looks fun, you know.
But
I mean, that's the, like, the specificity of my thinking. It was like that kind of numbskull thinking.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
That's what California is. There's a housing project near where I grew up called Stuyvesant Town of Peter Cooper. You know what those are in the city?
Yeah, yeah. They're sort of like a bunch of high rises that look like there's 50 of them and they're all the same.
Yeah. And they were built as kind of affordable housing, I think, for veterans of World War II. So they were built in the late 40s and 50s. But they had little parks and they had little parks, and it was like this self-contained, like, suburbia. Mm-hmm. And I do remember wishing from time to time that I lived in Peter Cooper, because it just seemed like it was a real neighborhood. Like oh, my park, I have my own park.
Yeah.
And there's green, there's grass, there's a tree, you know, there's a tree.
Yeah.
So I did, that was, if I ever coveted like suburbia, it was coveting Stuyvesantown, Peter Cooper.
Yeah. That's sad. That was your idea of idyll, you know?
That was my idea of nature.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now you were a big sports guy, right? Was that when you were young? Was it all sports all the time?
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. I just wanted to be in the park. I'd go to Peter Cooper.
Yeah,
and baseball, basketball, tennis, swimming. Yeah, I just loved. As I got older, I loved team sports more than like individual sports. But I loved it.
And you played in high school? Was that kind of?
I played in high school. I played a little in college, and that was really like my first heartbreak about like what am I going to do. Because once I stopped playing like organized sports, which was my second year of college.
And it was basketball?
Basketball and baseball.
Oh, and baseball. Playing. You were on both teams.
Yeah, I stopped playing both.
Wow.
And it was a real like redefinition for me. I felt like a great failure. You know, like I hadn't done what I wanted to do. I was heartbroken. And then it was like, well, what am I going to do with my life? I mean, it wasn't like I thought I was going to be a pro. I mean, that was obvious enough, but I thought at least for the next 4 years, I'm going to be doing these things. And then,
yeah,
I mean, that's how I identified myself, as a guy chasing a ball.
Right. Right. As an athlete who also read books.
Yeah.
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 Well, I mean, how long did that period last where you feel that kind of, well, you know,
the heartbreak of it.
Well, yeah, that sort of sense of failure that turns into readjustment. Yeah. And then you kind of, you know,
I don't know how long it took. I mean, I remember just feeling like it's almost like that feeling of, well, you're not a liar so much as like, I guess I'm not who I thought I was. It's a shitty feeling, but it's a very necessary one to reinvent or it's necessary to be honest like that with oneself in a way.
Yeah.
And also to realize that that's not actually a self-definition. That's just something you were doing.
And were you cut from the teams? Is that how it ended? I mean,
it's funny you ask, because I don't think I was, but here's the story. I'll try to tell it quickly. In the year 2000, which was one of your great gags.
Yeah.
And I was very happy to have been involved in that one because it always made me laugh.
Yeah.
But in the actual year 2000, the Lakers and the Sacramento Kings were locked in a big struggle for the Western Conference Finals. And I went to a game, I think it was game 6 or 7. And I had known just briefly, I knew the owners of the Sacramento Kings, the Maloofs, mm-hmm. the brothers. And as I was walking to my seat, I had great courtside seats. I was walking to my seat and I said hello to the Maloof brothers. And Coach Kirill, who was the legendary coach of Princeton, was now, at that point in 2000, an assistant coach for the Sacramento Kings. And I said, I'd love to say hi to Coach Kirill after the game. And they said, sure. And so I went down, I watched the game. It was an amazing game. I have to say that the refs kind of handed it to the Lakers. I mean, it was a great game, but I felt like the Kings were the better team at that point.
Yeah.
I'll probably be run out of L.A. like I was run out of Vancouver. But I went to the Maloofs after the game, and I said, oh, man, that was really horrible what happened in the fourth quarter there. I understand if Coach Grill doesn't want to see me. And they said, no, we told him you were here. He wants to talk to you. So, if you wait over there. It's like, and I wait in that tunnel, you know, the great tunnel that everyone where there's light out there and it's dark in here.
Yeah. And that weird feeling of waiting for someone after a show or you know, like standing around with your thumb up your ass feeling in the way. Yeah,
exactly. And I see backlit coming from the tunnel, and he was a little round man. This little round figure like ambling towards me. And I knew he'd had a heart attack recently. I knew he wasn't doing great. But he gets within like 20 feet of me, and it's only him and me now. And I start to raise my hand to wave at him. And he says, aren't you glad I cut you? And I say, well, coach, I think you didn't cut me. I think I quit. he said, no, I cut you, but look how good you're doing now. I mean, you should be glad I cut you. You're doing so good. And I was like, Coach, I think I quit. I don't think you cut me. And we had this thing. So many years later.
Well, you both feel proprietary about your success, you know.
Yeah.
It was my decision.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think the hard thing about that kind of situation too, and it's good to get it out of the way young, which is when you have an idea of yourself and the world tells you, no, that's not who you are. And you can fight it, but usually the world wins, you know, like when I try to tell my kids if there's somebody's being an irritant and then more people are saying you're being an irritant, it's a democracy. So if three people say you're an asshole, you're being an asshole, you know, like you can have all the righteousness in the world and all the picture of what your motives are. But no, if you're being an asshole, you weren't being an asshole, but you were like, you thought, you know, you were an athlete and they're like,
you thought differently.
No, you're not. You're good. Sure. Whatever. You know, have fun. You got a hobby, but no, find something else to do.
Well, I mean, it's, you mentioned your kids around this and it's certainly something that I thought about more later as I became a parent. Because you don't think of it that way when it's happening. You know, you don't think of it as, oh, the world is just conversing with me right now.
Right.
No, it feels like everybody hates me.
They're stealing my dreams.
So, but when you have kids, like, yeah, you know that like every dream that they have, they're not all going to come true, but you want them to, you know, you want them to. And then you just realize, yeah, it's almost like your heart will break more for them than it would for yourself. And then you realize, oh, it's just all about resilience. You know, this whole life is just, everybody's getting knocked down every day. You know, that's just the way it goes. And social media aside, which gives you like this false view of everybody's perfect life or not. But, you know, it's just the ability to kind of say, oh, you know, like you asked me how long it took. See, I don't know. You know, that's the, you know, how fast can you bounce back? You know, how long did it take for me to go, okay, I guess I'm not going to be this great athlete. That's not who I am. That's not going to define me.
Yeah.
Now is the rest of my life going to be one of those guys sitting around on podcasts talking about what a good athlete he used to be? Maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at the coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
Yeah, no, it is. It's like you say, resilience. It's also, too, I don't have a religion, but I do sometimes say I'm a devout relativist. And it's in comparison. I am always like, I think it's a very valuable thing when you think that you got it shitty to go, but wait a minute. Here, check out these other lives that are way worse. And then you just kind of be like, well, all right, I don't have to be a Pollyanna about it, but I at least can kind of know that I'm not being persecuted by the universe and can kind of move on.
Yeah, I mean, there's that, but there's also, I mean, I do talk to my kids about this as well. It's like, you are entitled to your own human pain, no matter how good you seem to have it.
Yeah.
Because the gig comes with a lot of pain.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, then you mean the gig of being alive.
Yes.
Yeah.
So then, I mean, there are other really bad hands and really bad rolls of the dice that people get. And that's obviously legitimate too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But even if you don't think you have a right to feel bad and you do, I'm not going to say to you, you don't feel bad.
Right.
Or you shouldn't feel bad.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, maybe you can feel a little better. Maybe you have it, maybe you do have it better, but you know, that's the first noble truth of the Buddha, right? Life is suffering. So, you know, I take that as my gospel anyway. I'm not like a dark, dark person, but
yeah,
you know, there's a lot of hurt but I get what you're saying. You know, it is good to relativize sometimes.
Yeah.
And just be grateful for the good things.
I just find it. I don't know. I've always found it useful for so many different ways. I've talked about it before, for motivational ways, especially like going into a very daunting business and looking at successful people that I just think are not that great and going like, well, if that fucker can do it, then all right, I can do this. You know, it can give you confidence in that way. But you're right. People, and especially any, you know, and in social media, anything I can say stuff about, you know, my car breaking down and people will say, oh, I bet it's a nice car. And at least you have a car and you have a job and you're on TV and shut the fuck up. Don't ever complain.
Right.
You know, all right. Okay, fine. You know, whatever. But, you know, everybody's life becomes their life. And I'm sure, as you know, as you go through, I've seen many, many people who have it all and who are fucking miserable and addicted to the misery in some way, which is just, I used to kind of be fascinated with it, but now I'm just bored by people who don't seem to want to take the reins of their own, just not even like some crazy happiness, just like, no, not being a fucking mope, not hating everything all the time, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, like what that puts me in mind is like people who are self-obsessed. Self-obsession is pretty boring, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I just get bored and then I get angry, you know, at those people just because I'm like, I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, yeah. Especially when you got to work with them. That's what you're getting at? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Let's name some names.
But, no, this isn't that kind of podcast. That's my next podcast.
You know, you touched on something I think that's very, very valuable, which is, you know, you put it in a way that was kind of, you know, funny, but it's true because I had similar experiences where when I first got on sets, because like I hadn't been, you know, an actor, I hadn't thought of myself as that till I was maybe 26 or 27. And, it was actually on Chaplin. I had a small role on Chaplin, and there were lots of very well established actors on that. And I saw them work, and I was like, and it wasn't like, oh, that asshole can do it, I can do it. But I was like, oh, it's not, you know, they're good. Yes, they're good, but it's not
magic.
Yeah, I think I can do it.
Yeah,
I can do it. Like when I saw it up close, I see it in the movie theater. It's like, oh, I can't do that. I mean, that's magic. And then I would see it up close and be like, oh, yeah, no, they're good, but I think I can do it.
Yeah.
You know? And that was valuable for me to see that.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're right. I mean, you're right. That is a more sort of gracious one. My version of that was when I got out here and was doing this Brady Bunch show, which, you know, I mean, I was making a living, but not a real living. Mm-hmm. But we would go, groups of us.
What year was that?
92. Yeah, 91, 92. Yeah. When we would go groups of us, and I had a pickup truck, so I used to load up the truck with stuff and people, and we'd go to the beach.
That's dangerous.
It was the 90s. life was cheap back then. But we used to drive out to the beach, and I would look at just all the houses on the hills as you drive down PCH, and I would think, show business paid for most of these, I bet you.
Right.
And ancillaries of show business, not necessarily, you know, not every house on that hill is owned by a famous director, actor.
There's some agents.
There's some agents in those. There's some guys that hang lights in those. There's, right. you know, and that, that was tremendous, because also I was looking at it from a very Midwestern, this is an industry, this is a craft, this is a trade. I'm learning a trade. And
absolutely. And I always took, like, for me, it's more on a television show because it's a long-running thing. And you know this. You were part of a show that was a living for a generation of workers there.
Yep.
And I've been a part of two or three long-running television shows. And I felt like I was a tradesperson too. I felt like I should show up on time and I should show up prepared. And everybody here is doing a different job of this thing.
Yeah.
And we're all kind of holding each other up and making a living.
Yeah. Know? Did, when you started working in television and you started to enjoy the success of the X-Files. That was the first big regular gig, right?
Well, I actually, I did a show called Red Shoe Diaries where I was like the host of this show.
Which Diaries?
Red Shoe.
Oh, Red Shoe Diaries. Right. It was kind of dirty, right? Wasn't it?
Well, I don't like to say dirty. I don't like to use that word.
I do, because that's what appeals to me. Is it dirty? It had that, what they call cable edge. Correct.
Yes. Exactly.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
That's the way I like to think of it. In fact, when I got the X-Files, I was still doing that, and I only existed on the margins of the show. I was like, I did the pilot. We called it a movie. We thought we were doing a movie at the time, because it was so, cable at that point was so kind of amorphous that it was like, oh yeah, this is a movie, but then they might show it on some TV channel, and then there'll be other kind of episodes of it. I was like, really?
Okay.
So I was in the pilot, I was in the movie, and then it got picked up and would continue. But at the end of the pilot, my character who has found his dead lover's diary, and in that diary has read about this affair she was having, and she ends up killing herself because she can't square, you know, her lives.
Right.
And I find this, and, you know, I'm heartbroken. I didn't know her. She didn't have to die. And I take out an ad in the paper for women, if they have secrets that they can't tell anybody, they can't tell their shrink or their priest or whomever, tell me. And
pervert.
Dirty pervert. And so they send me their stories, which are very similar to Penthouse letters when it comes down to it.
Of course. But,
that was the extent of my responsibility. I was a lonely guy with a border collie walking around the docks of San Pedro. And I'd take out of my trench coat, I'd take an envelope and I'd start to read, "Dear Red Shoes, you'll never guess what happened to me."
Yeah.
And then that was the show. So I could do, while I was doing the first year of the X-Files, I actually would come down to LA for maybe one weekend every 3 months and shoot like six wraparound
episodes. Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, did going from Ivy League education, searching towards a PhD or, you know, heading towards a PhD in literature to sci-fi television show, like, and, you know, with that enjoys a kind of pop success, were you okay with that? Like, was there something where you felt like you were, you know, you were focused on higher minded pursuits and now you're kind of.
Yeah. I mean, I just wanted success at that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And did I not want to be hugely successful? No, I wanted to be hugely successful. I wanted that show to be as popular. I didn't think it would be. Nearly. Yeah. I did not think it would be at that point.
It was weird. That was what was so great about it was that it was so fucking weird.
And I, at that point, you'll remember, TV was like, it was like the ghetto, you know, it was like you, if you were an actor, you didn't want to be doing TV. It's different from now. And the X-Files is one of the reasons it's different. You know, the show started getting movie worthy, you know, on television right around that time. So my plan was like, no, I'm just going to, I got rejected from so many television shows and they'd always say, he's a movie actor. And I'd be like, oh yeah, you're damn right. I am. You're damn right.
Thanks for not giving me the job. You're right. I am too good for this.
Well, this movie actor can't buy that sandwich. I was not, you know, I didn't want to do television. I didn't want to do it. And I also, but that didn't, you know, the work that we did, I thought was, you know, movie worthy. And then, you know, the fact that it was sci-fi to me, again, same thing. Sci-fi back then was sci-fi. You know, now sci-fi kind of rules the universe, you know, but, and every good actor, every great actor wants a sci-fi franchise now. How do I get in the Marvel universe? You know, it's like, but it was different back then. Sci-fi was considered like, you know, Twilight Zone or whatever. So there was part of me that was like, you know, this is a little like sci-fi, you know, it wasn't my bag. But then, you know, the show was what it was, and I didn't see how good it could be, and I didn't see how kind of flexible the storytelling mechanism would be.
Yeah. And I think it also, too, was like it was a turning point for legitimizing genre stories.
Mm-hmm.
I think that probably, you know, I wouldn't say like without the X-Files, we wouldn't have the ubiquity of the Marvel universe, but it certainly softened up the mainstream to like being like, yeah, all right, this stuff that's kind of meant for kids or, you know, weirdos.
Comic book stuff.
Yeah, this niche stuff is not going to fly in the mainstream. And then it did, you know, I can't think of anything that kind of had a paranormal, occulty kind of. You know, I mean, going back to like the Night Stalker, maybe, you know, or
yeah, but that's
Twilight
not
Zone.
Worldwide phenomenon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's probably right. And I, you know, so I was on the side of, you know, of the past, the way I looked at it. It was like, no, not what I want to be doing or associated with, but I'm going to do this pilot because it's good and it's probably too good to keep at that level. And all that stuff. So I was wrong about it all, but you know, I kind of hung in there and also needed to get a lot better. I needed to work.
Yeah.
I didn't know how much better I needed to get, you know?
Yeah.
So I was very fortunate to be employed and to teach myself.
Yeah.
Over a couple of years of 14 hour a day, 10 months out of the year, being on set, figuring out what the fuck it is I do, how am I going to get that through with this grind? You know, how am I going to relax enough? How am I going to keep myself interested? How am I going to learn? You know, it really forced me to figure out the kind of work that I wanted to do and to be decent at it. Cause when I started, no, I was barely treading water, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it is, I mean, you know, one of the things I'm happy about that I get to do is I'm going to hopefully get to act more because I miss acting. And I find, you know, in the last 10 or 11 years, my acting has pretty much been one-off guest spots or a couple things where I've had an arc in. And it's exactly what you say, that when I come back, somebody hires me to do a recurring the first day back, I feel like absolute shit. I mean like that when I look at the end thing, which I don't do that much, I don't enjoy watching myself. I think, ugh, You're not good at this. Right. And then, you know, a couple episodes in, I'm like, all right, there. It's, you know, it's muscle memory and you're kind of getting back to it. And like I say, I don't have any technique. My technique is just, and I, people have objected to this when I've said this, but like, it's just being a good liar. Like, I'm not really this guy. And I have to think, like, how would I put myself over as this guy in real life? And so I have to sort of think about on a, you know, granular level, how do I sell this lie? And it's like, well, I would maybe do this. I would talk like this. I would try not to.
But that's exactly what a technique is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, yeah, I know, but people just to couch it in like being a good liar, they feel like, you know, that somehow not, it doesn't sound noble. And it's like, well, it's not that noble. I mean, you know,
well, I mean, maybe call yourself a good storyteller.
Okay, that's what I'll do from now on. Yeah. Yes, you heard it here first, folks. Now, when X-Files becomes a juggernaut, are you too busy with your 14-hour days to kind of be flummoxed by that? Or, I mean, what was that like?
Well, there was a lot of it that was just went on somewhere else because I was
working.
But yeah, I mean, you know, after a while, you get the feeling. That this is crazy, but it's also, it's happening to you.
Yeah.
It seems normal.
Yeah.
It seems like, yeah, that's what happens.
Yeah.
It's easy how things get normalized so quickly. You know, when I think back on it, I think, wow, you know, that was something. Like many things were something, you know, but, you know, at the time it was just like, yeah, let's, you know, certainly there was the scrutiny, you know, the kind of like instant kind of like recognizable nature of my face was weird, you know, at first.
Yeah.
And then that becomes normal too. So it's just a strange thing.
Yeah. Does it, the thing that I find about being publicly known that's kind of I still am ambivalent about is kind of the need to withdraw because of, you know, the attention that you get just going out, you know, taking your kid to the grocery store and stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that something that happened in your life? And I mean, and how, sure. How have you coped with that?
Just be like an asshole in public.
Long cigarette holder and constant sunglasses.
I don't know. I think that's the difficulty is figuring out, you know, sometimes I just think, hey man, I gave it the office, you know, I gave it the office. It's like, but then, you know, eventually you do get a little more perspective on it and you go, I have to understand this equilibrium here. I know what it's about.
Yeah.
And am I going to teach this individual a lesson?
Yeah.
Or am I just going to, you know, just make them what they think makes them happy?
Right? Yeah.
Or whatever. It's like, so, I mean, I went through times teaching people lessons like I do sometimes when I'm driving, you know, because they need a driving lesson. but, you know, then I stopped. You know,
yeah.
I was like, you know what? Just be of service and you know, be a decent human being.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it does. I find energy to be a finite resource. So it's like, how am I going to do the energy to just be sort of nice and get through this? Or am I going to school this person on how rude it is to interrupt my lunch? You know?
Exactly.
I want to make sure.
No, my name is not Mulder. My name is not Hank Moody. I didn't write that book. Whatever. You know, like, and then eventually just like, yes, I'm Mulder. Yes, I'm Moody. Yes,
sure,
I'm Mulder.
Sure. Yeah.
Do I want to make a greeting for your voicemail? Sure. Yeah, bring it to me.
Bring it. Come on. Yeah. It's just, this is a funeral, but whatever. we got time before they close the casket.
All right.
I want to make sure we get to your new novel, which is called Truly Like Lightning. And I just want to make sure you get a chance to plug it here.
Yeah. Well, that's, you plugged it. Yeah, you just said the name.
Well, but you know, tell me what it's about.
Oh God, it's an epic, Andy. I sold it to Showtime. We're gonna make it as a television show.
Oh, awesome.
But, Yeah.
As a mini series, or is it, would it be like
an ongoing? It would be ongoing. For instance, the second season would not have, it's not in the book. The first season would be the book.
Oh, wow.
But it's, I guess the hazy basic premise is about this former Hollywood stuntman who I play, who converts to Mormonism because he has to in order to inherit this bunch of land out by Joshua Tree that his grandmother, a Mormon, left him. And in the course of like the charade, like an actor trying to act like a Mormon, he actually converts himself and like really starts to believe it. And he ends up moving to this huge miles and miles expanse of land out in Joshua Tree with three wives and raises 10 kids off the grid for the last 20 years.
Wow.
Not the kids have never met another human being.
Wow.
So by a turn of events, he's kind of pulled back into society and so are the kids. So it's really, it's about the struggle between, you know, religion and modern society, science and faith and the past and the present and, you know, parenting, really.
Yeah. Can you look back on like one moment that kind of sparked inspiration to tell this story? Because that's a big rambling story, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a few, you know, that's the way it happens in the novels that I've written. It's usually like a couple of like lightning bolt kind of ideas that link up.
Yeah. And you mentally squish them together. Yeah. And they become a bigger idea.
Yeah. So, you know, this one actually, it actually goes back to the X-Files. When I was writing an X-File, I had an idea for one, which was really about, it was like a meta one where they were making a movie in Hollywood of a case that Mulder and Scully had been involved in. And they were, you know, invited to set and I cast Gary Shandling to play Mulder and Tay Leone, my ex, my wife at the time, to play Scully. So it was a fun thing for me to do. And, but the X-File, the gag, the caper in the middle of it was based on this guy named Michael Hoffman, who just had a Netflix documentary about him a couple months ago. He was a forger of Mormon documents who ended up.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah. So he killed a couple of people with pipe bombs to try to cover his tracks. So I was fascinated by this guy because I was reading about him at the time. I was fascinated by him because he had said that when he was forging Joseph Smith, the founder of the church, he was so consumed with the spirit of it that it wasn't really a forgery. It was actual, it was more like channeling. It was more like he was Joseph Smith.
Yeah.
And as an actor, you know, we were just talking about it. I was like, oh, that's, you know, you hear actors talk about that. I mean, that's what actors are doing supposedly. And we're also forgers, you know, in that way. Mm-hmm. That way, you know, you say, I'm a liar, you know, forger, same thing. So I was fascinated by that. So I kind of created a story around a forger of actually Jesus Christ's words.
Yeah.
So I translated Mormonism to just Christianity. But because I was interested in that story, I did do a lot of research around Mormonism at the time. And I'd always been kind of fascinated by it. And there was a professor of mine in New Haven named Harold Bloom who wrote about, called Joseph Smith a genius, like a literary genius, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was fascinating to me. I was like, oh my God, you know, cause my idea of Mormonism was more like, you know, the Book of Mormon, you know, like the cliched, you know, version of it. So these things kind of started rattling around my head. And then there was, you know, a plot device, you know, that they aside from polygamy, there was another tenet that Joseph Smith held and Brigham Young too, that is no longer practiced, called blood atonement, which is there are certain sins that are beyond the atonement of Christ's sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And the only way that you can personally atone for those heinous crimes is to have your own blood spilled. So I thought, oh, wow, that's a great plot device. Like if you don't believe in the justice of society, but you have like a religious justice, that fights against, you know, society.
Yeah.
And so these things started to like tumble around, and it only took 20 years, but I wrote it.
Yeah, no, it's I definitely want to check it out because I have an interest in Mormonism. I mean, I have read about it a fair amount. The classic Joseph Smith book. Is it No Country Knows My Name or No Man Knows My Name?
Yes. Yeah.
No. Yeah. Man. Yeah. And it's just, I mean, it's amazing. What's amazing to me is that the recentness of it is, and that's kind of like the point of this guy forging documents, is it's just a lot easier because it all kind of happened 10 minutes ago within terms of, you know, civilization time. And yet it's become, it's as legit as any other religion, you know, and it's as all the stuff that you can look at Mormonism and go, wait a minute, this took place in Cahokia, Illinois. And that's, right. You know, that's BS. That did, you know, that's just people, some sort of collective cultish belief.
But Noah's Ark. Well,
right. Or walking on water, you know, turning loaves into, you know, making loaves and fishes appear. Right. It's all, you know, magical. And it all just kind of depends on the belief of the people.
Yeah. Well, it's also what you say is exactly appropriate for what I was doing and what Bloom was talking about, which is that there's a kind of flying by the seat of your pants vitality and present day-ness to Joseph Smith. You know, he's not looking back 2,000 years ago all the time. He's saying, hey, it's happening now. It's happening in America. So it's very American because Americans like to think, hey, it's all happening here. This is the place where it happens.
Yeah.
So there was something very American in it. There's something very energetic, not like, you know, looking 2,000 years ago to the miracles, but looking like now to the miracles.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was like cool to me. It was like, yeah, why not? Why do we have to be born late? Why can't we be born in the best times? You know, why can't we be born in the time of miracles? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And also, you also then get to kind of re-examine what the notion of piety is and put in all kinds of convenient parts that allow you to, you know, marry more than one person at a time, which is all, you know, that's the other fascinating thing about that religion is the notion. And it's kind of like causes them trouble these days. Yeah. The notion that anyone can be, you know, there's no pope. Anyone can have a direct conduit to God. And when you can do that, it's like, you know what? God says, you know, that we should chrome the house, you know, and, you know, God says I should blow up the city's water supply. And, you know, and when you get down to that, once you give that kind of egalitarian freedom to a religion, like some crazy shit is going to happen and some crazy shit has happened.
Well, I mean, you're describing Martin Luther as well.
Yeah. Describing
Protestantism, which says you don't need the mediator of a priest to talk to God. You're describing the advent of the printing press, which said the priest doesn't own the Bible. Everybody can have one in their own home and can read it whenever they want. And we're going to translate it into your language. You know,
So
that's always going to be the move.
Yeah,
it's always going to be. People are going to say, hey, there's this thing, but there's a limited supply and we're going to hold on to it and we'll let you know what's going on. And eventually people are going to go, I think you got to share a little more. And if you don't, then we're going to have our own supply chain.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Religion. It's crazy. Anyway,
we solved it.
We'll be right back. Well, is there something that you've left undone? I mean, the second question of these three questions is, where are you going? And is there something you've left? Because, I mean, you do so much and you have so many irons and so many fires. And here you wrote this novel that you've been stewing on for 20 years. And now it's very possibly going to be a TV show. Mm-hmm. Are there things left undone?
I don't know if there are actual things, but I keep on liking to do stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I certainly am not trying to do the same thing again, but in my experience, every project that's different calls out a different part of myself and different, you know, you're a different person every day. So things just change through the work. And I'm fascinated by that, you know, every step of the way to watch how it's all different. And I do love collaborating. I love meeting new people and working with people that I like, whose work that I like. So I guess I wouldn't say like, oh, there's something I want to do that's specific, but I would say that I'm still hungry to keep doing things. I don't know mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Oh, it makes absolute sense. I mean, yeah. It's like, I've never had a plan. I've just, my plan's always been to be open and then to make a choice when it comes, because that's all anything ever is. That's building a house, that's cooking a meal. It's just a series of decisions that life presents you, and you go, oh, I'll go this way or I'll go that way, you know.
I know it's so impossible, because sometimes you realize that little decision was so important to the rest of your life. And once you start to think about that, like, for instance, I tried to turn down the X-Files because I already committed to doing a little part in a television movie mm-hmm. for a friend. And I was like, no, you know what? I can't go back on my word. I said I was going to do that. And like, well, my agents, just, they all came down on me and they said, you have to not do it. You know, yeah. We'll get you out of it. But if it was left to me, I would have said, you know what? I believe more in my word than I do in this thing or whatever.
Yeah. So, yeah, yeah.
But Kierkegaard, another philosopher, said the moment of decision is madness. You know, it's like, because when it comes down to it, like, you can like write your ledger down, pros and cons, and, you know, and all this stuff, but you know, every decision you've ever made has come down to like, fuck it, I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
You know? So that's the crazy thing when you realize it's all instinct and just like, oh, I feel like I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
I just try to say yes as much as I can.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I mean, you know, you don't want to look like an asshole and do some piece of garbage, but
well, I've done that too, you know. So
oh boy, I sure have. I always call those jobs, they paid me enough. You know, like, there's like, I know it's not great, but shit, here comes the number, and yeah, I gotta do that.
You have said they couldn't pay me enough. Have you ever said that? They couldn't pay me enough to do
that. But sometimes they can. I certainly can. Well, you know, we're kind of talking about lessons here, Kierkegaard and all.
Yeah.
Isn't there
a moment in your podcast where you always talk about Kierkegaard?
Yeah, but that's just because it's a exterminator company here in Burbank, and they're a sponsor.
Oh, I thought you were big in Denmark. Forgive me.
No, it's Kierkegaard Pest Control. On Olive Avenue in Burbank. what's the biggest lesson you've gotten out of your own story? You know, that you can impart or not.
It's not my own story, but it's something that I'll tell my kids. It's never as bad or as good as it first appears.
Yeah.
And I'll also say, you know, stay on the train because the scenery will change, you know, like that.
Yeah, so yeah, yeah.
Just sit down and wait a bit, you know.
Yeah.
Also, much like, I think it's in King Lear, one of the characters says, this is not the worst so long as we can say this is the worst.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
We're not dead. We're still saying, oh, this is the worst.
Yeah. No,
it can't be, because you just said it. So
right.
These things, just like, just to try and get like a long perspective, even when you're in the heat of the moment, it's a tough thing to do. But that would be, you know, whatever ups and downs I've had, career life and stuff like that, it's never been as great or as bad as it seemed.
Yeah.
At first.
Well, thank you so much for taking this time with me. This has been
great. This was as great as it seemed right now.
Come on.
We just disproved.
He was an asshole the whole time. He said all kinds of great stuff.
Andy, I just wanted to, like I said, like towards the beginning, I just wanted to say, I guess it was my way of saying thanks, you know, that I always appreciated what you did on TV. And, you know, I appreciate as just a guy sitting in a room looking at it, but also as a guy sitting next to you, that I dug your thing, and it's your thing. And, you know, even though you can't explain it, which is probably why it's your thing. I just wanted to say, you know, I dug it. So
thank you.
You know, I just wanted to be as inarticulate as I just was.
No. I mean, it's, I never know what to do in the face of a sharp tooth compliment ready to sink its fangs into me. And
well, it's good we're just on Zoom where you can just press that leave button.
Yeah. I muted you. Whenever I hear you saying nice things, I just mute you. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again, David. And thank all of you for listening. And we'll be back next week with more of this stuff.
I've got a big, big love for you.
The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It is produced by Lane Gerbig, engineered by Marina Pais, and talent produced by Galitza Hayek. The associate producer is Jen Samples, supervising producer Aaron Blayert, and executive producers Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Cody Fisher at Earwolf. Make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.